I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Tom Devaney, poet, teacher, critic, super talented reviewer who teaches at Haverford College, whose books of poems include The American Pragmatist Fell in Love, one of my favorite titles, Tom, and a series of small boxes, and who for some years was our very own program coordinator here at the Kelly Writer's House, and by Susan Schultz, who joins us today and all this week from Hawaii, where she has taught since 1990, poet, teacher, critic, and publisher through her remarkable Tin Fish Press, which she founded in 1995, whose books include, as Poem Talk listeners will know, the remarkable Dementia Blog. And by Leonard Schwartz, whose many works of poetry include A Message Back and Other Furors, The Library of Seven Readings, and Language as Responsibility, published by Susan's Tinfish Press, who famously hosts the radio program Cross Cultural Poetics, who teaches at Evergreen State College in Tacoma, Washington, and whose writings on poetics and the Mideast conflict can be found on the Common Ground News Service. Hey, Tom, welcome back to the Writer's House, your old stomping grounds.
Nice to see you,
Al.
Nice to see you.
And hello to Leonard and Susan. Susan, your first time on Poem Talk, and your visit here this week, I think, has been the first time at the Writer's House. Is that
yes,
possible?
Yes, very much.
And it's been lots of fun.
It's been great.
Around.
You've worked me hard.
It's true, and you're so comfortable here. You're like, you know, a member of the family. And Leonard, your second visit to the Writer's House, or maybe third?
Second, indeed.
And second time in Poem Talk.
Oh,
glad
great.
You could make it.
Great
Washington.
To be back.
Well, today we're going to be talking about a poem by Lynn Dinh. It's called Eating Fried Chicken. Penn Sound has two recordings of Lynn Dinh performing this poem. The one we'll hear now was recorded in 2007. The poem was published in a book called American Tats, T-A-T-T-S, a book of 2005 published by Chax Press. So here now is Lynn Dinh reading Eating Fried Chicken.
Eating Fried Chicken. I hate to admit this, brother, but there are times when I'm eating fried chicken, when I think about nothing else but eating fried chicken, when I utterly forget about my family, honor, and country, the various blood debts ye owe me, my past humiliations and my future crimes, everything in short but the crispy skin on my fried chicken. But I'm not altogether evil. There are also times when I refuse to lick or swallow anything that's not generally available to mankind, which is, when you think about it, absolutely nothing at all. And no doubt that's why apples can cause riots, and meat brings humiliation, and each gasp of air will fill one's lungs with gunpowder and smoke.
So who's the brother being addressed in the first line? Leonard, any ideas on that?
Interesting. I thought of that as, you know, Philadelphia speak, as Lynn Dinh is a poet of Philadelphia, coming from a particular, maybe African-American vernacular.
It could be anyone, or it could be an African-American brother. It could be a presumptuous address. Susan, what are you thinking about that?
I was thinking the same thing, especially as it follows a poem called Lucre, about a man who hates African-Americans. Especially as fried chicken is often stereotypically identified with African Americans.
So this is a mark. He's using the addressing as a way of situating us thematically or geographically. Tom, your thought on this?
And it could be this general someone speaking in to someone else, or, you know, a larger audience, or I hate to admit this, brother. It's kind of like a...
Why does he hate to admit it, actually? Is he willing to indulge in a racist stereotype by saying, I'm eating fried chicken? Well, and speaking to you and doing so.
I think he's, as he often is, he's playing between the symbolic and the literal, between something that identifies you as having a particular identity and something that undercuts that identity completely.
Yeah, also already from the very first mention of brother, there's this appropriation of someone else's vernacular, some other way of speaking, some other way of eating. And I think consistent in Lyndon's work is a kind of tongue-in-cheek appropriation.
Appropriate with of food involved, tongue-in-cheek.
Particularly with tongue-in-cheek, that's right. And everything is, of course, appropriated from everything else, ultimately. In language is something you sort of pick up out of the gutter someplace and use anew. So I don't think it's necessarily critique of appropriation. It's in some ways an embrace of it.
Tom, is there anything good about his thinking about nothing else but what he's doing? Is it possible that he's saying, I'm just eating fried chicken. I'm not participating in racial valuation of what I'm doing. I'm just eating fried chicken. And so therefore thinking about nothing is a positive, or am I reading that wrong?
When I'm eating fried chicken, when I think about nothing else but eating fried chicken, there's kind of a, there's so many levels to read it. There's like a survival level. One of the things I like about Lynn is that he is a poet of critique, and he turns the critique on himself. So there's no pieties here. There might be a kind of gluttony, there's some kind of, you know, we live in a mechanized food world of, you know, these great factories of chicken. So here we are. And maybe he's enjoying it.
Well, and also I think there are problems with family, honor, country, and blood debts.
What do they have to do with eating fried chicken?
They have a lot. I mean, I live in Hawaii where food is highly symbolic. If you want to write a poem about your grandparents, you might talk about the food that's put on their grave if you're an Asian American person. And I think Lynn doesn't want to be marked as an Asian American writer, but he's very willing to play with that identification between food and identity precisely in order to call it into question. And
so
when he uses food,
he's saying, don't make me mean. I'm just eating fried chicken. I dare you to make me mean something by that.
Yeah.
After all, the poem is very funny, and it is very playful in terms of its in terms of its tone, in terms of the directness of its speech. I think of Lyndon as a poet who is sort of, or at least I started off thinking of Lyndon as a poet who's stepping from the street into the curb, looks down at this formless junk or formless stuff in the gutter, and then, you know, picks it up and starts to play with it. But that would be true of Walter Benjamin and the rag picker as the artist. The artist is the rag picker in society. What's striking in Lyndon is once he picks the stuff up, he realizes it's been manufactured to look like that. It's been manufactured to appear formless. It is junk in its very origins. And so junk food obviously is part of the aesthetic of this poem.
Tom, if he's in a way, I think we're getting toward an idea that he's comically protesting what he's saying no to these meanings, and yet he keeps conjuring them mm-hmm. by saying, well, I don't think about honor and country. I don't think, as a matter of fact, I don't think about what you owe me.
But you owe me
but
something.
You must owe me something. Now, who would you be, and what the heck would be owed? Could you be the same brother that's addressed in the first line? In that case, we've got a Vietnamese-American mm-hmm. talking, I'm thinking, to an African-American veteran, because war is mentioned a lot. I'm thinking Vietnam vet is what I'm thinking, and I'm not sure why. Huh. A conversation between Vietnamese-American eating fried chicken and relating to this Philadelphian vet and saying, I'm not thinking about everything that's got going on between us.
Sure. Certainly the poem facing it, Lucre, does mm-hmm. speak about the narrator, the first person I, presumably Lyndon's indebtedness to his house painter boss, who was a Vietnam vet.
And
right?
who's a racist.
And who was a racist, exactly.
Against black people.
But yeah. Just staying with this poem, I just would say, like, reading it on the page and listening to Lynn, where there's like a tone and there is some sense of that there's humor there. There's also just a more emphatic kind of, you know, you can read it just sort of as a sort of this person who's like has taken all the trouble inside of him, and he's it's internalized, externalized. And I'm really thinking when he the various bloods that you owe me, like early Baraka and this poet that is important to Lynn, Etheridge Knight, and a kind of this sort of going on the offensive, but like early Baraka, sort of implicating himself fully in everything.
Which is why it's my past humiliations mm-hmm. and my future crimes. It's a there's going to be trouble later. But right now, there isn't any, because I'm not... The skin I'm talking about is the crispy right. skin on the chicken. Mm-hmm. This is a complicated thing about race. Do you want to untangle it a little bit, Susan?
No.
No? Yeah. Okay.
No, I know. I mean, you're right to point at the word skin, because crispy skin on my fried chicken is just... It's just itself, potentially. Mm-hmm. But skin, in the other terms that we're invoking... are racial demarcations, religious ones. I mean, apples being the Christian problem and the Jewish problem, and meat being the Hindi problem, that have caused wars.
Interesting. Yeah, I also wanted to say maybe somewhat against a kind of a racially determined reading of the poem that I feel Lyndon sublimated dialectical materialism very strongly in this poem, in the sense of food... matters is profoundly what we're in competition for in a global sense. Scarcity of resources in a global sense.
Is this why apples can cause riots?
This is why apples can cause riots. If there is only one apple in the city, or 17 apples in the city, and there's 70 of us, all of them want apples, right? And of course that's going to lead to there may be this one unconflicted moment in which I'm blissing out on the skin of my fried chicken, but the rest of the time I'm going to be committing crimes against others in order to get my share of scarce resources.
But I'm not altogether evil. There are also times when I refuse to lick or swallow anything that's not generally available to mankind, which is, when you think about it, absolutely nothing at all. And no doubt that's why apples can cause riots, and meat brings humiliation, and each gasp of air will fill one's lungs with gunpowder and smoke.
Tom, I sense in you, particularly playing off the performance, which is, I love listening to Lynn read, because it's, even when he's angry, it's funny. I sense in you, you know, you're trying to reconcile the deadly serious conversation we're having about
these
issues.
It's essentially
a funny poem.
I agree. Yeah. I just think you can't get away from the intensity of the poem. It's the past humiliations, my future crimes, and then just kind of, you know, chicken can be all these things, but it, you know, the crispy skin is flavor. You know, it just could be like. Like, I'm in this indulgence, I'm in this escapist moment. I don't care that it's, you know, conflicted. I'm just doing it. I mean, I'm being ridiculous, but that's how I feel.
Well, and you know, I'm thinking of a poem from his first book, the Mud Men at Earth Cafeteria, I think, where food is every bit as disgusting as excrement. And I think this actually is an interesting moment in Lynn where food is actually pleasurable. I think oftentimes it's not to be distinguished from scatological stuff.
You think
stuff.
It's pleasurable?
Well,
I'm feeling a disagreement coming.
Well,
pleasurable in a kind of animal way, or a kind of where one empties out of subjectivity altogether and is just this crunching and this munching on pleasure in the sense of absence.
But that pleasure is rebuked, I think. I think there's not a lot of irony in... the downside to utterly forgetting about family, honor, and country. Because it's not clear whose country we're talking about. Yeah, right. I mean, I keep thinking, and I have no real evidence for this in this poem, but I'm just thinking of reading Lyndon, you know, all throughout. I keep thinking about the relationship between that crispy skin and the racial tension and war mm-hmm. and breathing gunpowder and smoke. I'm thinking... despoilation and defoliation. I'm thinking of genocide. I'm thinking about skin burning. I'm thinking about, you know, how angry we are about each other. And the end for me is this is a devastating end mm-hmm. because it's almost deep memory Meat brings humiliation, and each gasp of air, which is after all what we need to do to perform the poem, fills one's lungs with gunpowder and smoke. It's almost a memory of the heat, the fog and heat of war. And so it ends with that kind of going back to the scene of the crime, which the brother seems to have experienced on one side and this Vietnamese American on the other.
Yes, Ceylon has a famous line about breathing in the incinerated cells of Holocaust victims when he comes back to Germany. And
I mean, how
Lyndon's
could you
line
eat, how
echoes
could you be
that.
Eating fried chicken? I think Tom was referring to this about the kind of way we get our food now. How can you be unconscious of the...
Well,
I'm not doing an animal rights thing here, but how could you be necessarily, how could you be unconscious of the mass preparation of food, which is a kind of mass murder, and just go and just munch along and not think about the way we've constructed ourselves? I don't know.
And I think there's, I mean, just there's one part of this poem that's sort of a kind of a bodily consciousness. And then there's this thinking part, like you think about it, you think. So that's like what I was thinking, like the Baraka Etheridge Knight, the kind of wisdom tradition that he's sort of, that it's inside of Lynn, and then his body, you know, and just consuming something that he needs to sort of to eat, to live or whatever. Yeah. But it seems like he's just like, I don't know, everything's fallen off. Here I am.
Yeah, maybe pleasure was the wrong term, but I think that there is...
Well, we seem to have thought that it was the wrong term, but it might be the right
term.
Well,
maybe not pleasure, but that moment of forgetting of all these awful, all-consuming global issues, that moment of forgetting while consuming the chicken, is that to be dismissed?
Yeah, I don't think so in the poem. Maybe, who knows, maybe in some... metaphysical way it is, but not in the poem, right?
But why would he say? But why would he say, if you're right, why would he say in the next stanza, but I'm not altogether evil?
Well, yeah, that's...
What's he recuperating at that point?
I mean, any Jewish...
That implies that it's an evil thing what he's doing in the first stanza.
But I mean, any good Jewish comedian knows you have to make fun of yourself before you start making fun of everybody else,
right?
So it's a
way of saying...
And I think he's setting up that dynamic. That, you know, look how slovenly I am. Look how completely lost I am in the act of consumption. And only then, after you establish that you oneself is evil in that way, or oneself is part of the machine, can you then go on to...
Well, what is it that he's refusing to lick or swallow? What is the refusal in that next line? I'm not altogether evil, but there are, I must tell you that there are times when what? How would you translate that in political or ethical terms? There are times when I'm going to go on a hunger strike. There are times when I'm going to refuse to participate.
Yeah, well, I mean, again,
eating of anything that's not natural.
He's again playing the game of literal and symbolic. Lick and swallow are clearly not just to do with food. And so that's why my reading of the apples and meat is a little less dialectically materialist than Leonard's. It's more symbolic, but I think the poem wavers back and forth and back and forth between those, and also perhaps a little bit between the forgetting and the intensity of the, oh no, I'm in this. Tom?
I like how Lynn continually is implying a lot of a causation in the stanzas, and but I'm not, you know, coming from one, the first stanza, but I'm not altogether evil, and implying that it's just following along when it's actually a leap. And he keeps leaping and leaping and simultaneously positing causation. And it's sort of like part of the, you know, just the formal tension of the poem, which is all over the place.
I hate to admit this, brother, but there are times when I'm eating fried chicken, when I think about nothing else but eating fried chicken, when I utterly forget about my family, honor, and country, the various blood debts you owe me, my past humiliations and my future crimes, everything in short but the crispy skin on my fried chicken.
I want to think about the Lyndon who has to some degree, at least at the time of this recording, repudiated poetry as inefficacious. Who's come to the point, I think, after writing this book, which is some years old, that the work he wants to do, politically and ethically, isn't really well done in poetry, and expecting more out of the poetry community. So I just want to I want us to go wide on Linden for a second on his writing and grapple with the fact that this poem could be read, at least retrospectively, as anticipating the need to distance from this kind, the kind of work that's done in this poetry. I want to read it as a metapoem, if possible. Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to take me up on that? Does this anticipate in any way Lynn's current position that, you know, I think I need to do other things? So now he does a blog called State of the Union, which is photographs full of juxtapositions about crime and poverty and urban life and so forth.
Yeah, I referred to a kind of a sublimated dialectical materialism in the poem, but ultimately I think this poem bails on that and is more about a kind of tragic inevitability of being corrupted and being part of the corruption, so that a politics that comes out of this poem would not tend towards activism, right?
What would it tend toward?
It would tend towards a kind of tragic resignation despair. And despair.
Or memory.
About
if I'm right about the ending, or memory, mm-hmm. which is...
When he's eating chicken, he doesn't remember anything.
If you are so complicit yeah. in all of this right. evil that exactly. you're eating a piece of fried chicken is complicit in it, then what can you do?
Yeah. I think that the things that are similar is that there's a humor here. It's there, but there's a vehemence in this poem that he won't let go, and he's translated into the next chapter of Lynn Dean, and I hope that he continues to writing, because I think he does things in a poem like this that, you know, it's other work that he's doing. He's doing whatever he's doing, but I really feel that these are more powerful political poems in my, you know, just a kind of a critique where you're pointing outward. It's so bodily and kind of cerebrally, kind of cognitively, it's vexed, and there's no sort of untangling it. And I think that's why it's a kind of powerful poem on many levels, humor, blood.
This is why I appreciate the address, the specific address of the first line, because this is not a poem for us necessarily. This is a poem at least that proposes that it's being specifically addressed to someone who, while perhaps on the other side of the war or the war's experience, has in common that kind of extremity, that life in extremis, and that it's not necessarily a poem for us. It's certainly not a poem for the poetic community, mm-hmm. because he's not being flashy poetically necessarily, and he's even kind of, it's a very demotic kind of, you know, terrain here. He's keeping at bay a kind of poetic analysis that we're engaged in at the moment, and wanting to be addressing himself to the brother of the first line. You know, we could do this for a long time, mm. so why don't we, I mean, we could, couldn't we? Mm. So why don't we go around and just offer one more thing or thought or observation about this and see where we get. So, Leonard, you look like you have five things you want to say. Pick one.
One thing, I'm thinking of Brecht's distinction in Mother Courage, where he distinguishes between the little anger and the big anger. Little anger, which never leads to revolutionary activity or politically efficacious activity, because it burns itself out. That's what little anger does. Whereas big anger doesn't look like anger at all on the surface.
So this is frustration at little anger?
And so this is frustration at little anger, and I think I hope for Lyndon's work, a movement into big anger in the work that was not going to look like anger on the surface, but is going to have the kind of political authority and the political efficacy that Tom was just speaking about, because I sense that there in some of Lyndon's other work.
If I could follow on that, I would say that perhaps one of the problems is that this is still a lyric poem. This is still an I talking to a you. And the politically efficacious poem, arguably, is not a lyric poem. It's something different. So that might be part of what the frustration and the internalized anger is here. It's just, it's me and it's not us.
But when I was reading the last stanza, I was thinking, and no doubt that's why apples can cause riots and meat brings humiliation. I was thinking about the Arab Spring, and this vendor in Egypt is talking mm-hmm. about not being able to sell, you know, his food and having to pay so many people off. And this kind of like aggregate thing that happened in so many countries this past spring. And mm-hmm. and that the little anger and big anger distinction, you know, maybe there's tipping points. And I think this poem... Mm-hmm. It has that available inside of it. So I feel that this is a serious poem for Lynn. Even in, you know, he definitely comes out of a lyric tradition, and then he, you know, so many things cross over on top of him and inside of him with poetics and experimental mm-hmm. poetry and all kinds of things. So that's why I really want him to keep writing, but at least he has these books.
Yeah, and I'll just add a final thought. I always struggle in this poem, and I was there in the room when he read it the first time. I remember being struck by it. The connection between the blood debts that are owed and the refusal or anger to be eating something that's not generally available to all people. So he's focusing on a kind of plenitude that he's engaging in, the ultimate, you know, big bucket of fried chicken is sort of too much. Even just one piece feels like too much. And engaging that mindlessly is a way of forgetting or repressing or denying that there is general privation and that origins are blurred, either the origin of himself, if he's in fact engaging the memory or the historical memory of the Vietnam conflict, and the place where that brother might be if he were very conscious, and the refusal, the sort of hunger strike, on plain ethical grounds that not everybody has access to this, and therefore I need to get pissed off, but I need to get pissed off at myself mm-hmm. because the pleasure of the poetry, the humor and the fun of writing a poem that's just about eating fried chicken and doing that kind of thing. Overwhelms him and he has to back off of it constantly. And that dance that he does, he goes from the pleasure of poetry to the being pissed off at himself for engaging in such a thing. Mm-hmm. That's the dynamic. And the reason I like this poem is that I think it ends with a kind of memory, a deep memory of some devastation where the blood, the scene of the blood debt gets breathed in. And instead of then exhaling into a poem, it's the end of it. So I really grapple with that. I find it difficult. Well, we like to end poem talk with a minute or two of what we call gathering paradise or gathering inferno, I guess, after this poem. it's a chance for several of us, or maybe if you're quick, all of us, to spread wide our narrow Dickinsonian hands to gather something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Tom Devaney, I think you have some paradise with
in the
you.
Mail today, a book called What It Is Like, New and Selected Poems by Charles North from Turtle Point Press and Hanging Loose Press. Charles North, I haven't read it, and it's a cover by Trevor Wingfield. So this is in my bag, and I really
and
like
it. And it's lovely cover.
I love Charles North, and I love Trevor Wingfield.
Terrific. So. Great recommendation. Thank you. Leonard Schwartz.
The most extraordinary encounter I've had in poetry in quite a long time was with the work of the Chilean poet Raul Zurita, freshly translated a new book of his entitled Inri, published by Marek Press. There's also a couple published by University of California Press, Purgatorio and Paradiso. Zurita is a poet who survived the Atacama Desert and the concentration camp in the Atacama Desert during the Pinochet regime, and who writes poetry of that period that isn't explicitly political, but simply reimagines the ocean in such a way as to make one hear the voices of the disappeared. It's an extraordinary Orphic
spell
work.
The poet's name.
Zurita.
Terrific. Thank you. Susan Schultz,
well,
gather some paradise.
If I may...
It's been paradise
toot.
Having you here.
Thank
with us.
You. I've really. Enjoyed it so much.
Really.
If I could toot the Tinfish Press horn.
Please
just
do.
Slightly. A new book by a poet named Jai Arun Ravine, who began her life as a Thai American in West Virginia and now is transgender, transnational, transgenre, pretty much trans everything. It's a wonderful book, and it was gorgeously designed by designer in Hawaii.
And I would like to gather some paradise, which is to, you know, for me involves visiting the page of Cross Cultural Poetics, which is an ongoing series of radio interviews conducted by our own Leonard Schwartz here. We are now up to how many episodes?
230 something.
And I believe all of them are on the Penn Sound Cross Cultural Poetics page, which is a totally remarkable thing. What we're trying to do now is we're going back through all of them, and we are segmenting them, and we are connecting them to the author pages of the participants where we have one. So if you go back to Cross-Cultural Poetics, you're going to see an amazing resource, much more capacious than Poem Talk, which is this little carefully edited curriculum. And I think what you're doing, Leonard, is deep and wide at the same time. It's really fabulous.
Thank you very much, Alex.
My pleasure. Well, that's all the KFC we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests. Thanks so much to my guests, Tom Devaney, Susan Schultz, and Leonard Schwartz, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Gregory Janikian, Michelle Taransky, and Annie Seton, coming to us from Bard College, gather with me to talk about one of Cole Swenson's garden poems. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.